On December 4th, Lauren and Aaron hosted a live taping of Bombshell at the World War I Museum in Kansas City, joined by New York Times journalist and former Navy EOD tech John Ismay, and Steve Leonard, KU professor, former military strategist, and the creative force behind Doctrine Man. The crew discussed the American public's understanding of the forever wars. Who fights? To what end? With what government oversight? And what civic obligation in these conflicts looks like? This taping was presented in partnership with the Center for Civilians in Conflict and Open the Government. Hello. Welcome to a live recording of the Bombshell podcast. I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
And I'm Erin Simpson. And those of you who aren't related to me went to college with me. So thank you very much for coming to the World War I Museum in Kansas City this evening. It is freezing cold in December in the Midwest, and we're still really, really excited to be here. We have Steve Leonard from the University of Kansas, John Ismay.
Hi, everybody.
From the New York Times. And as ever, we have lots to talk about.
So as a quick background for those of you who have not listened to the podcast before, Aaron and I and our other co-host, Radha Iyengar, started the Bombshell podcast in January 2017 with the idea that national security was something that we talked about a lot in Washington in the most esoteric, academic, unapproachable terms possible. But it was something that we felt really passionately that a lot of people needed to understand better. And that national security was not only something that should interest you, but it could be fascinating, entertaining, depressing. It should be an issue that you are certainly more understanding of, but also something that you maybe want to contribute to in some way in terms of your own public participation. So we started a podcast that sort of grew beyond, I think, our expectations in terms of what it meant to us, but also what it meant to our listenership. And we're delighted to hear... come here today to talk a little bit more about one of our favorites, I guess, issues, our most frequent issues, the war on terror. We have a segment that we talk about frequently called This Is Still a Thing. Well, the war on terror is miraculously still a thing, given that it is our longest conflict in American history, now 17 years and running. And when Dan invited us here to talk about transparency, the war on terror, and the American public, it completely fit within our wheelhouse. So one of the reasons that this is a topic that I think has a lot of kind of fascinating dynamics is that the United States military is the most trusted institution in the United States of America. Polling is done on this every year, and by far, it is the institution that people think is the most trustworthy and would basically trust to do anything on the planet, whether it be defend us from aliens, to go to war against terrorists, to defend us against plagues. They are the people that you go off and trust. They are also an almost $800 billion institution. They make up most of our discretionary budget in the United States. But they're also one of the most mysterious institutions that we have. People trust it inherently, but they also, frankly, are pretty disconnected from it on a day-to-day basis. So as a first matter of discussion, we wanted to talk about a little bit about who is the United States military. We have an all-volunteer force that is about 1.3 million-ish active duty troops between the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marine Corps. Not quite, but more or less equally divided. But it's not quite representative of American society. We've got about 85% men and 15% women in the military, though that's changing over time. The racial and ethnic demographics are pretty well reflective of the American people, except when you look at the officer corps. And in that case, it is about 90% Caucasian, with the rest being African American, Hispanic, and other ethnic and racial makeups. And a lot of the folks in it come from very specific regions of the country and don't come from kind of a widespread dynamic. And that's kind of an interesting and important question to me is when you think about the fact that America has decided that we want to have volunteers be part of our armed forces and represent us overseas in conflict and defend us from national security threats, What does it mean to be a volunteer as part of the armed forces? And I wanted to ask Steve and John in particular, as our veterans on the panel, what does it mean to be an all-volunteer force?
I can kind of jump on that one. I grew up in the all-volunteer Army. I came in during the Reagan administration, which probably makes me the oldest guy on the stage tonight. But it's I had the benefit.
For sure. I was born on the first day of the Reagan administration, so you're definitely the oldest guy in state.
Yeah. If the hair doesn't give it away, right?
We spend a lot of money to make sure our hair doesn't look like that, Steve.
That's a conversation we have at home all the time. It's an interesting conversation. We have, at the university, we actually have a panel that discusses on a regular basis, so probably once a year. And we brought in some folks from the Korean, Vietnam eras, and today to talk about what it really means to be an all-volunteer force and the motivations behind it. And I think that's also important is, you know, I can honestly say that I came in with extrinsic motivations that I, you know, they were going to pay my way to college. They were going to help me out. I came from a middle-class family like most people in the all-volunteer force do. But you stay for different reasons. I stayed for intrinsic reasons. I thought I could make a difference. And that's where the volunteerism really, truly, honestly kicks in, when you think you can do something and you stay.
John?
I saw a pretty wide swath of America in the time I was in. I saw enlisted sailors who had bachelor's degrees, some master's degrees, and you'd think they'd want to be officers, but they just wanted to operate and do the job that they wanted to do. They didn't want to be officers. I also, on my first ship, so I started off on a destroyer in San Diego, and I met some bosun's mate, who were Mexican citizens. They were working towards being legal permanent residents, and they split their time between Tijuana on the weekends, and they came across to come to work. And so I feel like I really saw everything in between. And I'll tell you what, I think one thing that really struck me, a friend of mine posted on Facebook, she's a Naval Academy classmate of mine, just had command of a destroyer. And she said, I remember 25 years ago talking to somebody at the Naval Academy. She didn't think it was something she wanted to do. She didn't come from a military family like I had and like so many other people I served with had. And they asked her, what do you want to do? And she said, I want to command a warship. And it was a male who asked her the question. This guy laughed at her, not knowing, or she didn't know that was something that she couldn't do then. And you know, she just decided, that's what I'm going to do, and she did it. So I see like a really incredible cross-section of America.
This is actually one of the divisions within the Department of Defense right now that's not talked about as much publicly, is whether or not the military should reflect the American society or not, or whether it should be more of a, if not elite institution, then more of an institution that is like putting itself there deliberately, and therefore its skill sets and background and its inherent, you know, strength that make it part of the military. So Aaron, I'm curious, what does it matter if the military reflects society or not?
Man, you asked me the hardest question, Lauren.
I know, I love you.
This is a Rada question, and she's not here to answer it. This goes to a lot of the themes we want to talk about throughout the discussion this evening, which comes to questions of accountability, the public's role in the military. And I think, you know, Tom Ricks's book, Making the Corps, which is over 20 years old now at this point, and it has, you know, one chapter is 1 week of boot camp at Paris Island, and it talks about how the Marine Corps creates new Marines, which could be a long conversation for all of us to have here. One of the themes, this is all pre 9/11, this is all before the war on terror, one of the themes that he kind of stumbles into is the degree to which the fundamental values of the Marine Corps are quite distinct from modern American society. And so there's this question of kind of, do we create with an all-volunteer force a warrior caste? And that's often the language that's used, and that's kind of harkens to Sparta or to, you know, less democratic places, or do we want an all-volunteer force that is, in fact, reflective? And I think it comes to this question of, you know, can a warrior caste, can an organization, an institution that begins to demographically look different and have values that are different still be accountable to a democratic public that looks different from them, that maybe values different things from them? What does that dialogue look like? And I think we're, especially this many years into the war on terror, still trying to navigate exactly those questions.
So So I mentioned at the beginning, as Aaron just alluded to, we are now into the longest stretch of armed conflict in American history in 17 years or so. And it's something that I think that not only do a lot of the American people not quite realize this, but actually even members of Congress don't realize to the degree to which the U.S. military is still deployed overseas, where and why. And just to give a quick overview, while we have in the past been at deployment levels of close to 200,000 troops, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now we have troops in Afghanistan around 15,000 or so. We'll talk about why this is problematic, that we don't know exactly the number later on. In Syria, around 2,000 troops or so. In Iraq, I actually couldn't find a number, remarkably, and that's fairly problematic for the U.S. government. We'll get to that later, as I said. And then also have deployments in Yemen, in Africa, and Southeast Asia, in areas that are not quite conflict, but almost all the way there. And so going back to my original point about whether or not the American people realize this is problematic, I'm curious, from the perspective of the folks up here, and you guys deal with different people every day, do people realize what troops are doing overseas right now? Are they thinking through the risks that they're undertaking? Do they understand the missions, or is this a mystery to them?
I can walk into the Pentagon press office and they don't know where people are deployed or what people are doing, if that tells you something.
And that would be a Pentagon press office that is staffed by military personnel.
Exactly. Okay. And trying to get straight answers.
That seems like a problem of some sort, maybe?
It doesn't seem like it's working the way it's supposed to. If it takes that much effort to, at the place where they're supposed to know, I would argue they're supposed to have this kind of information readily available. It's not available. And I think part of that's by design, and I think part of that's because no one's made it their job to know.
So just thinking about the impact that must have on, you know, if you're a Marine or a soldier overseas who realizes the American people is very distanced from your experience there. Steve, you write and work a lot with connecting with troops who are serving in the field right now in lots of different capacities. What is it people don't understand about that experience?
This kind of gets to the whole civ-mil divide, the whole civ-mil divide question, because you have an American public who, in many ways, is largely ignorant of what's going on. It unless it's the story of the day, that attention span passes, and then you forget. And it's, as I stress to people, it's more and more important that we tell our stories. As veterans, as acting service members, that we tell our stories, that we connect to the public, so the public understands what we're doing, and the public then has a vested interest in what we're doing, our success or our failures, and then of course that leads back to accountability, transparency, those broader discussions that we need to be able to have. And the fact that we can't have those because we can't even say for sure how many people we have in each theater, that's where the problem begins.
So we've each talked a little bit about the civil military gap, and it's something that super wonks like all of us on stage here kind of freak out about on a daily basis without necessarily explaining to people what is it that we mean. So here's a few kind of background statistics to think this through. Right now, about 61% of the American people are connected in some way to someone who is in uniform or has been in uniform before. So they know them, they have kind of vaguely understand their experience. When you look at people who are under the age of 30, that percentage drops to around 30%. So younger people have far less familiarity with folks in uniform than folks who are at a slightly older generation, which makes sense if you think about most of our grandparents and great-grandparents served in World War II or had some connectivity to it. Going beyond that, you also look at a force right now where 80% of folks in uniform had a family member who was previously in uniform before. So there's a family tradition that goes along with service right now that means that the group of folks who are serving in uniform is getting narrower and narrower as they kind of decide whether or not to make that choice. 25% of troops had a parent who was actually serving in uniform before. So kind of going back to my earlier question about whether or not this reflects the American people, to what degree does that divide matter? Is this something that we should be aiming for because, you know, we're self-selecting into a group of folks you really, really want to serve? Or is this a problematic for the American people?
Personally, I feel like it's problematic because I think there has to be a public connection to the people that you entrust to defend the Constitution, to represent us overseas or anywhere else. You have to have that connection. And you mentioned the term warrior caste, which is the longer I think you have an all-volunteer force, it draws from the same general demographic of the public, and over time, it becomes a much smaller and smaller representation of America. Even if it manages to be a diverse representation, it's a small representation. People that come of age don't have somebody in their family necessarily who tells them, hey, this might be a good career for you. And so it becomes a family affair. And I can look at my own family and say, although I grew up in a family that wasn't necessarily military, pro-military, I grew up in a family where every generation going back to the Revolution, somebody served. And how many families can say that? But my son and daughter-in-law are in the Air Force. My son-in-law is a Navy pilot. And you see, it carries forward. And then it becomes a smaller and smaller representation of America, and that becomes a problem because fewer and fewer people know somebody. And there's a less of a, the connective tissue starts to degrade.
I think one thing will be interesting to see, there's a relatively large incoming class of veterans, both military veterans and other national security professionals in the new Congress. And folks have been kind of cheerleading that, but also lamenting the reduction in veterans over the years in the halls of Congress. And it'll be interesting to see if they have distinct voting patterns, if they support higher or lower budgets, if they're more or less comfortable with the use of force. I think that the societal questions that Steve raises are kind of the bigger pictures, and geography is really one of the interesting ones there, as we've closed lots of bases, especially in urban areas, in expensive areas like the Presidio in San Francisco, in favor of more affordable places like Fort Hood or Fort Drum, which are much less scenic, as it turns out.
Fort Leavenworth.
Fort Leavenworth is gorgeous. Okay. We will all have you know. Right above on a very lovely bluff, one of the very few hills in Kansas overlooking the Missouri River. But it creates this geographic divide, which compounds some of these issues. But I think this is one of these longer-term questions that will be interesting to see, in particular, how this class of Congress members is able to advocate moving forward. Shall we shift gears?
Yes. What are we doing exactly, Aaron?
And why?
So
as we thought about discussing the war on terror, and one of the challenges we have on the podcast in general is that we actually don't disagree that often. Those of you who listen to us kind of know this. One of the things we do have some disagreement on is actually the efficacy of parts of the war on terror. And so I actually wanted to make sure that we spent some time talking about how we got here, why we thought that it was an important national security decision to deploy troops in a variety of countries, employ force in counterterrorism operations. Most of us all here will remember why we invaded Afghanistan after 9/11. The invasion of Iraq is somewhat related, but honestly quite separate, and that's part of a much larger sort of strategic debate. But a lot of the other campaigns that Lauren mentioned are somewhat less familiar and were not part of a large public debate in terms of what we're doing in Yemen or Somalia or even Syria today. We're less sort of foregrounded than those large decisions. I was struck by some recent polling data from the Pew Research Organization that talked about 72% of the American public supports taking measures to protect the United States from terrorism. Meanwhile, there's actually quite little support for the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. And so I wanted to sort of up to the audience or to the panel, what should those measures include? If we have if it is important to be informed by public opinion in terms of our counterterrorism policies and approaches, but yet we also have some ambivalence about large-scale military deployments, how should we think about that counterterrorism policy? I'll go back to Lauren, since she gave me a difficult question to begin with.
Oh, God.
Turnabout is fair play.
Okay, so our original theory of the case is that we just threw lots and lots and lots and lots of troops at the problem, that we would somehow figure it out. And this is one of the miraculous and beautiful things about the U.S. military, is give it a problem that it doesn't quite know how to solve, and it will try lots of things to experiment with. And something that Erin, that I will turn it back over to her, can talk about in a second, is the degree to which we experimented appropriately with the theory of counterinsurgency or not in both Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think the American people haven't really grappled with the decision about whether or not terrorism is a military problem or an intelligence and police problem. We have talked about that in sort of academic circles and in op-ed pages, but it, given that the American people, at Taryn's point, feel very strongly about doing a lot towards terrorism, counterterrorism responses, there seems to be a preference for doing so to some degree out of sight, out of mind. So we tried the throwing lots of troops at it approach, and people did not, I wouldn't say it wasn't terribly successful. I will say that it was not terribly sustainable. We moved in the Obama administration and decided instead to try the covert operations, drone strikes, special operations forces approach that took out senior leaders, for the most part, of terrorism organizations in a couple different countries. Well, more than a couple, lots and lots of countries. And that was, again, not terribly sustainable from a democratic accountability perspective, because we were effectively going to war in countries that we weren't actually talking about and causing civilian harm and harm to civilian infrastructure in ways that would eventually get out into the public and people didn't quite understand, to include Congress, to include the American people, and even to include some elements of the U.S. government. And that comes back to kind of the larger point we're talking about here. If we are pursuing these aims of counterterrorism in the American people's names and don't necessarily know why, how, and what risk we're taking, then how successful can we possibly be?
So let me channel Radha here for a second, which is to make the argument that since 9/11, we have not had another large-scale attack on American soil. And to what do we attribute that? Is that a credit to our counterterrorism policy and perhaps even to the war on terror writ large? Or is there some other set of factors that contribute to kind of the demise of Al-Qaeda, the reduction in threat, the lack of capability? Is there something else that has prevented this from happening? Or is it sort of dumb luck on our part? John?
I mean, I think luck plays a role. And to the earlier question, I think about how we got here, I just wanted to offer my own idea, is that after 9/11, I heard for the first time that the president's first job is to keep the American people safe and not to support and uphold, defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign, domestic, bear truth, faith, allegiance to the same. And so if then we look at the primary job is to keep Americans safe, I think then you look for threats. And then if you see threat, bomb threat, fight threat, and so I think it just sort of, we slid sideways into an era where we're a hammer looking for nails. And I don't know, to address your question, I'm not exactly sure why there haven't been other attacks. White supremacist terrorism is a far greater threat to the United States than Islamic extremism or whatever you want to call it. Also, I have no idea what extremism means, but that gets thrown around as a given. Like, if someone has a working definition of extremism, please let me know, because it would help. this idea that, like, we're ignoring the fact that we have, you look at the data from the Southern Poverty Law Center, look at Americans being killed by other Americans, it seemed to meet every other definition of terrorism, going back to the idea of it being politically motivated violence, to threaten or intimidate, to try and coerce people. I mean, I think that is a huge problem that doesn't get addressed, because we can look beyond it and say, well, what are people of a different faith, plotting to do? And part of it could be that we've largely depopulated Al-Qaeda, through kinetic action, through killing them. But I don't think we're any closer to trying to defeat the ideas that motivated those people. So I don't know if that's a good answer, but that's the one I got.
And that's one of my favorite things to say, is you can't kill an idea. You can try all you want to, but that idea still exists, and it will still exist as long as we continue to fuel it. And we fuel it through a lot of the kinetic actions that we take.
What do you mean by kinetic actions there, Steve?
A direct action that whether you want to say we're taking a missile strike and we're hitting and destroying civilian targets that happen to have one guy with a beard in the middle of the target, or whether it's a large-scale operation, as long as you do those types of operations, you continue to perpetuate your own problem. You fuel your own insurgencies to a large degree.
Think about how many people were said to have enlisted on December 8th, 1941, because of Pearl Harbor. Well, I think every time we drop bombs in some of these countries, in a way, it's easy to see how we're engendering the same kind of thought, like, I'm going to get payback. I want payback for that. And the more bombs you drop, the more people you motivate that, you know, that want revenge. Just and it's natural. It happened in America at Pearl Harbor, it happened on 9/11. And to think that somehow that ennobles us and makes other people's desire for revenge any less valid, I think is folly.
Lauren, what are some of the ways that we have to find accountability and oversight once we're well into these wars? So we've talked about Afghanistan and Iraq. Syria and Libya dominated many years of your life. Are there institutional mechanisms that we have for generating accountability, or are we kind of left to pick and choose where we can find them?
It's a great question. The United States government is really good at keeping track of a lot of things. And it's really good at generating rationales to send forces overseas, to spend money, to do things on the national security stage. What's really not good at is keeping track of those in a way that explains to the American people or keeps itself accountable for what exactly is it doing and why is it doing those things. It tends to be more of an act and don't necessarily ask questions later sort of mechanism, with some narrow exceptions. And this has actually gotten progressively worse over the last couple of years, that it was never terribly great. When you think about, we talked at the beginning of the show about how many troops are deployed overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and elsewhere. And the reason that I know the answer to those questions is not because the Department of Defense has put those numbers out. It's more because journalists like John and others on the ground have figured out ways to add those numbers up in a way that we can kind of sort of understand and kind of sort of make sense of. The number of troops overseas is not the greatest metric for how much our American commitment is to a particular problem set, but it's one of the best ones we have because it's a good metric to show here's how many resources we're willing to put against a problem. Here's what our literal risk in terms of blood and treasure is, blood in this case, to actually throw against a problem to make sure that we are protecting the American people against national security threats. And over the last couple of years or so, we have limited the numbers, limited the ways in which we're reporting those numbers. We have limited the ways in which we're reporting the kinds of operations we're undertaking beyond those theaters I mentioned in places like Niger, Southeast Asia, or elsewhere. And also not necessarily talked about the number of strikes or civilian casualties we may be inflicting in some of those conflicts. But the military itself says that's actually okay. You should trust us. As I mentioned at the beginning, it's one of the most trusted institutions in the country. So the question I kind of come back to is, to what degree does the U.S. Department of Defense owe that kind of information to the American people? If they are so trusted, and if they are, you know, kind of theoretically good at what they do, how much do they owe the folks in this room about what is it they're doing overseas?
I think that trust is misplaced.
Bam.
Say more.
I'll disagree. Because I don't think the trust is misplaced. I think the trust is in the right place, but the lack of accountability is definitely an issue. And without an accountability mechanism in place to call attention to those issues, that's where we run into a problem. And we have accountability mechanisms. When was the last time somebody read a special inspector general's report out of Afghanistan? I get those things like every month.
I love a cigar report.
We did.
I'm on the mailing list.
So these things come out every month, every other month. And what they do is they tell the horror stories of how badly reconstruction is going, where we're wasting money. And they're disturbing stories. But when I read one, the first thing I think is, I wonder if anybody in Congress reads these anymore. I don't think so. Because
Claire McCaskill used to.
I know. They did. But I feel like it's probably been
the nicest thing I'll ever say about someone from Missouri.
Yeah, exactly. But to get to your question, I don't think the trust is misplaced, but I do think the trust is in something that isn't reinforced. There's no verification.
I think that what a lot of folks see is, I mean, I'll tell you this. When I was growing up, I don't remember ever seeing F-18s fly over a football game. And now it's every football game, or it's Apache gunships, or it's some kind of plane. Who makes American flags that can cover an entire football field? Because that seems new, or at least since 9/11.
And who pays for them?
Well, the
Defense Department does.
and the idea that it was a big deal when it came out that it was the Department of Defense that was paying. These weren't spontaneous, outpourings of support. You know, like I cannot watch another video of like the surprise homecoming thing. Like that's super played out. And it's like, yeah, I get it. I went on deployments. It's good to come back. But like, you know, this idea that we have to manufacture some sort of saccharine, super sweet, syrupy love of country and then shove it in people's, you know, like make them swallow it. Like you can't go to a football game or a baseball game without it. You can't, you know, like watch NASCAR. You can't, you know, like this idea that we have to, you know, we're bad Americans if we don't have the most ostentatious public display of what somebody thinks is patriotism. Like, I think dissent is patriotic. I think, you know, holding the government to account is patriotic. I would rather, and well, I do. That's what I do now. You know, I mean, that's my job. And I'm much more happy as a person, as an American, by doing that than I am, you know, by probably just about anything I did when I was wearing a uniform.
So what's amazing to me about what you just said, John, is that my personal opinion is that Congress is terrified to do those exact things. The concept of criticizing the
oversight.
Military. The concept of criticizing the military has become a just politically unacceptable. Or even questioning the military to some degree has become politically unacceptable. But with very, very limited exception, just in the last week or so, the Senate voted to proceed a war powers resolution to halt U.S. support for coalition operations in Yemen, which, again, most people don't probably think of as American involvement in conflict. It's the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates that are pursuing counterterrorism operations, and the United States is doing a whole lot to support them. Congress, for the first time since the 70s, said, hey, actually, we don't want you to do that. It's remarkable to me that since 2001, we haven't actually pursued a real limitation of what the United States can do militarily overseas at all. They've had oversight hearings, they've had questions about what we're spending, but for the most part, it's been, if you're doing it, it probably seems like a good idea. But the thing that I've been wondering a lot is what would better congressional oversight look like? Because it's not just holding hearings and it's not just like grandstanding and tweeting. What would it actually look like?
I think it starts with having to declare wars.
By the way, if you've read the Constitution, Congress,
it's in there. It's actually in there.
Has the authority, the only authority to declare war. Apparently, no members of Congress have read the Constitution.
So, I think if you're talking about oversight, Congress would have to look at itself and ask why it's basically abdicated its responsibilities under the Constitution to declare wars. I think we could just start there.
So I want to jump on this too, because this is something that we talked about earlier, and that when you mentioned the Pew data, one of the things that came out in the Pew data was a 49% of Americans don't think that we're achieving our goals in Afghanistan. And my question right away is, what are our goals in Afghanistan? And that's a question I ask my students in class every fall. What are our goals in Afghanistan? My students are all Army majors and captains, and they look at me, and they'll talk back and forth, but they don't know what our goals are. And that's where Congress has to start. Let's start at the top. What are we trying to achieve? And then say, do you really think that's achievable? And if you do think it's achievable, how much is it going to cost us in terms of time and resources? And, oh, we're not going to do that. And that's where Congress needs to step in right now.
Is there a relationship between Congress's, I don't want to say fecklessness, but fecklessness in terms of oversight and the all-volunteer force? Does the all-volunteer force give the executive a lot of leeway to do a lot of overseas?
This is exactly why we didn't want to have a standing army. If you go way back in time to like the Federalist Papers, and come on, who doesn't want to do that? If you have a standing army, it's a lot easier to kind of throw yourself into all kinds of problems overseas. With another challenge is, I don't know if you guys have noticed, but our taxes haven't gone up since 2001. As dedicated to use of military force. Taxes have gone up and down for lots of other reasons, but nobody has come to us and said, actually, I need to raise your taxes in order to pay for a war, which we did in World War II, and we did in World War I, and we did in prior conflicts. So people are not feeling this in terms of their own pocketbooks at home either.
I remember coming back from my deployment to Iraq in 07, and somebody asked me, you know, what would it take to end the war? And I said, well, bring back the draft. I said, as soon as bring back the draft, no exemptions, women eligible, no deferments, once everybody has skin in that game, once everybody's number can come up in the blood lottery, then people will be contacting their members of Congress and asking them, what's going on?
What are we doing?
Yeah, and once you actually have, you know, everybody who shares, I think taxes, that's, you know, definitely one way to do it. And I looked at what it would take to bring back a draft. I did a story when I was reporting for public radio about it, and the Selective Service actually has these lottery machines, and they plug them in, like, I can't remember, once a week, once a month, and they test them. And, like, there's, you know, one has, like, the Julian date for, you know, what day of the year, then the other is, birth year. And the thing is, if you look at it, you know, we talk about drafting, or there were 10 million service members in the American forces in World War II. Like, as a proportion of the total population, that was pretty big. But if you tried to draft that many, you wouldn't necessarily need to take from that many, different years. You could actually get what you need pretty quickly. And I think they start with age 20 first. I think they go 20, 21, 22, then they go back and get the 18 and 19-year-olds.
Do you know who the biggest opponent is of returning to the draft? Senior leadership of the all-volunteer force.
Yeah. Really?
Who themselves? There were people 10 years ago who served with draftees when they were, you know, the most senior people when they were extremely junior. But I think the last draftee exited active service a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. So this tends to be the way that a lot of people think about connecting the American people to what the U.S. military does overseas. It's like, well, let's reinstate the draft. However, I think there's a much better way to think about how we connect the American people to the military, and that is Hollywood. Aaron.
Hollywood is great. Can you pass this to Lauren for me? Thank you. So one of the things that often comes up in the discussions of the war on terror, or as we sometimes call them now, the forever wars, is why there aren't great movies about the war on terror. And I guess what I first wanted to start with I want to ask John this question. So John's specialty when he was in the Navy, he was an EOD tech, right, which is an explosives and ordnance disposal tech.
You should show him your fingers, all of them.
Got them all. That means his job was to defuse bombs.
That's right.
So I want to ask you about the Hurt Locker. So the Hurt Locker is sort of this movie. Raise your hand if you saw the Hurt Locker. So it's basically everybody. Won Oscars, right? Yep. It's quite compelling, you know, all-star cast. It is loathed in national security and veteran circles as being a totally unrealistic, crazy fake, just like dialed to 11 sort of misrepresentation of what a deployment is like.
If it was a bad movie, it wouldn't have won the Best Picture Academy Award.
Forrest Gump won Best Picture. Come on, dude.
Yeah. Well, so I think I'm one of the few EOD techs, or, you know, I'm a former EOD tech who actually enjoyed the movie, and I enjoy it as that it's a good movie. And I say to people, if you want, you know, the most exacting form of realism, the movie would be like 4 hours long and it would be classified. because our, you know, we call our tactics, techniques, and procedures, we protect that way. We don't want to, like, put up on the big screen, like, so somebody, you know, in a movie theater somewhere can start taking notes, like, okay, that's the way the guy did that? Okay, I'm going to do it the other way. You know, and
right.
And so I think...
There is a demand amongst certain veterans and professionals for a verisimilitude that would be really, you know, unprofessional to put on a television or movie screen.
Well, yeah, I mean, this desire for every last thing being 100% exact the way it was, it's exhausting, and you can never... You basically set an impossible standard, and I don't want to prevent artists from thinking that they're not free to make art. And I think that to the question of the divide, like, if you have artists who think, well, I can't talk about that. Unless I know exactly what it's like, you don't get art. And I want to live in a society where artists are free to do that.
So on the flip side, how many of you saw Zero Dark Thirty?
Oh, I've got a Zero Dark Thirty joke. Go ahead, though. Are you going to do it?
No. Go ahead.
Oh, come on. It's Radha's joke. So our other co-host, Radha, who worked in counterterrorism for a long time, she says that Zero Dark Thirty would be a lot more accurate if it was just like 60 hours of lawyers having meetings in like poorly lit rooms and very, very little to do with, like, you know, torture and finding terrorists anywhere. It's mostly just like lawyers constantly, constantly meeting.
Well, that would be a lot more boring, I have to say.
And that's the reality of all this, is Hollywood can tell a good story or they can tell a story good. And if you tell the story good, you end up with, you know, hours and hours of absolute boredom punctuated by 5 minutes of intense activity where afterwards everybody goes to the mess hall, has a meal, and says, shit, that was fun. And that's it. But otherwise, our life is really mundane. It's not exciting, and that doesn't sell. Nobody wants to watch us sit around and talk to a bunch of lawyers, although that's really a lot of what we do.
I remember, was it 1998, we launched a couple Tomahawks into Iraq for something. My older brother Dave's cruiser, the USS Shiloh, was one of the ones that shot. And I remember I was finally able to talk to him. I was like, hey, how was it? Was it exciting? And he goes, I don't know. I was just coming out of watch on the bridge. We got the order, we navigate, you know, we drove to where we had to be, and we shot off a couple of missiles. I was like, then what? And he goes, well, then I still had 4 hours of watch. He's like, I still watch for 4 or 5 more hours, and it was just like any other watch after that. Like to your point, yeah. It's like, you know, boredom period, you know, broken up by, you know, what you might think might make a good movie. But I just think, like, I thought Jarhead was one of my favorites.
Jarhead was good.
Because it showed some really ugly stuff that happens on deployment. Like this, I remember watching that movie, I thought, now that is what deployment's
Jarhead
like.
Jarhead also made like $0.
That's too bad. But interestingly, so I don't know if people saw it, but it was a movie about Desert Storm in 91. And it came out, what, in 04, 05?
Three Kings?
No, Jarhead.
Oh, Jarhead. Right.
I was stationed in Guam. That's all I remember when I saw it. But
look, Guam standards for movie viewing are very different than real standards for movie viewing.
The thing is that it follows the book really closely, and at the very end, they just showed Jamie Foxx's character, who had stayed in the Marine Corps, and he's running around. And you know, time has changed because they got the different cami patterns, they got the updated weapons, and the idea is he's running them through, you know, somewhere in Anbar Province, you know, these new, younger Marines, and there's just this line that said, we're still in the desert.
Yeah.
And I just remember sitting there going, goddamn right, we're still in the desert.
Yeah.
I do wonder, I mean, so Zero Dark Thirty is, as you know, as a spy novel type movie, is an incredible thriller, and it's really well paced, and it's incredibly well acted, and it is fundamentally wrong about the narrative of how we found Osama bin Laden and the role that torture played in generating crucial intelligence. And so I do think that there is this challenge in, you know, telling a story good or telling a good story of, you know, yeah, it's like watching 24, right? And if you can shoot a guy in the kneecaps, like it makes for like much more compelling TV, but it turns out like that basically doesn't happen and definitely is not how a trained force would act. And so that's the sort of, I don't know, responsibility in some ways. On the other hand, you know, I was going back and trying to compare kind of war on terror movies to Vietnam movies. And I don't know that too many folks are looking at like Platoon or Full Metal Jacket or Apocalypse Now for, you know, great, you know, veracity for the lived experience of, you know, deployed soldiers and Marines in Southeast Asia.
That was, we talked about this beforehand, and that's where, when we talk GWAT movies, my favorite, and it's not a movie, is who saw Generation Kill in here? Very few.
Like
it's an
people.
HBO miniseries based on a Rolling Stones series that was absolutely accurate to every degree on the idiocy of what it's like to pack a bunch of people in Humvees and tear across the desert and invade a country. You get people who do the craziest things, and I could watch that movie and say, hey, I know that guy. I wasn't with that unit, but I know that guy. I know the guy who invaded a country and forgot to bring maps and got lost. Like, how do you invade a foreign country and not bring a map? But those people exist, and so that series is absolutely every episode was just memory lane. And I'm not a Marine, and the whole thing is about Marines, but the personalities, the characters—they're
very pretty Marines.
Yeah, it was amazing.
I can tell you, when you mentioned Full Metal Jacket, when I went to, I didn't see the movie until my Christmas break, my freshman year at the Naval Academy, and I watched it, and I just realized, I'm like, oh my gosh, all those people that have been screaming at me, they're just quoting
they're
Full
that,
Metal Jacket
right?
lines.
I sort of like how in The Sopranos, they're like reenacting The Godfather.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, I thought these people were terrifying. I was like, they're uncreative hacks. And I was like, I thought... like that was a greater crime. Like, I could handle getting screamed at and whatever, but then I was like, oh, but you're uncreative and you're stealing other people's material? Like, that's really too bad.
You know, what something that's missing right now in the GWAT's film and TV narrative is, like, any kind of attempt to, like, connect to social issues, family issues, like the day-to-day lives of the American people. Because you've had before, you know, MASH or, like, this is ridiculous to say, please forgive me, Major Dad. Like, that was, like, a film or a TV show in the 80s, like, with a guy in the military that was mostly about how he interacted with his family. Most of the ones right now are about super high-octane, let's go kill some bad guys. The emphasis is much more on their war experience than it is on, like, how that relates back to their day-to-day lives in the American society. And to the degree it does relate back to their day-to-day lives in American society, it's either related to PTSD or having American veterans be super flawed or even villains, like you saw in Homeland. It's an interesting, like, we kind of caricatured the American military experience and focused much more on the infantry experience than necessarily on, like, the broader depiction of what being in the military is like.
What's your favorite GWAT movie?
My favorite GWAT movie is one that Aaron hates called War Machine that has Brad Pitt in it. And it's amazingly brilliant, beautiful satire of what the American civil military experience in Afghanistan was like in that time period and just how truly stupid we are as a government. And that it makes me really happy to see that on film. Steve.
I hated the book, loved the movie. The movie made me laugh all the way through it because I have been on...
What's your favorite GWAT movie?
Yeah, my favorite was not a movie. It was Generation Kill. But I love that movie because I have been on those teams one too many times where, okay, new team comes in. Oh, yeah, we got our own strategy. We're going to start over from scratch. And there was never an interest in, hey, let's pick up what was there. Let's just take what and build on it. No, we're going to start over. And that movie, that's right here.
John?
I don't know if I have one, to be honest. Like, I don't really enjoy watching war movies. I remember somebody asked me, like, what would it take to accurately capture that experience? I thought, well, you'd probably shoot at Arlington National Cemetery, you know? And I said, it would be real if you showed an empty table at Thanksgiving.
Well, now I feel like an ass with my answer.
Is it a Thanksgiving movie?
No. It's Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, which I think is the best allegory for the war on terror that's been put together in book or movie in the last 15 years.
I hadn't seen it that way, but
everyone will see it.
You'll never watch Dolores Umbridge again the same way. I mean, a total agent for the war on terror.
All right, so now we've got some questions for you, the first of which was clearly written for me, and thus I will not answer it. The military generals are serving an outsized role in the highest levels of this administration. Yes, they are. Some people are comforted that General Kelly, who's actually Mr. Kelly, and General Mattis, who's actually Mr. Mattis, are advising the president, and others are uncomfortable with the military mindset enveloping the civilian decision-making. What are the consequences of this arrangement? Who has the strongest view?
Wait, I'll tell you, this is one I beat on people about all the time. You want diversity of thought in any group. And while I served with a lot of those people that are now in positions of advising others, I yearn for a time when we pick people that aren't all from the same background. Because if you don't have the diversity of thought, then you really don't come up with good solutions to problems. You end up with the hammer hitting the same nail over and over and over again, because that's what you default to.
Just finding new nails to hammer.
Yeah, there you go.
I would agree. I think, I had drinks one night probably a year ago with a friend of mine who's been over on sort of the clandestine side of special operations for a really, really long time now. And he'd asked me, like, what's it like to, I think he was asking me, like, what's it like to work in a newsroom? I was like, oh, man, it's great. It's totally different than the military. He's like, what do you mean? I said, my newsroom in L.A., it was like 60% female. And he was just like aghast, like, how could that be? And I was like, no, it was the best possible working environment, And I said, he couldn't understand how, like, you didn't get the best, or, he was like a let's let the best ideas win kind of guy. And I was like, not sure the room full of strictly white dudes is going to give that to you. And I was like, there might be some good ideas, but, like, I think representation, divert, you know, like there are people who won't speak up in those environments where there's one woman in a room full of like 30 dudes, right? When you start to have parity, when you start to have representation, you get ideas, you get thoughts. And this idea that we're just going to say, oh, well, this is a military matter. Let's defect to the guy that retired after 40 years in this institution. And he's sitting next to the other guy that did 40 years in the same institution, sitting across from the people who are in their 39th and 40th years on active duty. I just don't, you know, it's like there's a schoolhouse answer, and you're going to get schoolhouse answers, I think, from those guys. So I think it's really problematic for if you want to have, I think, the most effective government.
So that actually connects brilliantly, thank you for the segue, to the next question, that in comparison to other NATO members, as well as Israel, the United States lags behind in gender equality in the military. For example, only recently has the Army Rangers School been open to women. What is your current assessment of gender equality in the military today, and where can we go from here?
That's a good question.
I can tell you that prior to these last combat exclusions being dropped, the Navy EOD program was probably the most intense program that women could go through. They had to meet all the same standards, and the physical screening test is the exact same one that you have to go, you have to take to go through SEAL training. I think the runs times and the number of push-ups, you know, maybe a little different, but it's the same thing. Like 500 meter swim, 10 minute break, put 2 minutes of push-ups, 2 minutes of sit-ups. Pull-ups, no time limit, 10-minute break, and then a mile and a half run. And, you know, we had women who far outshone men, you know, who could run them into the ground, who could, you know, run them into the ground and then knock out 25 pull-ups when we got back to the compound. You know, and I think CrossFit's actually been an amazing thing, because I think it's helped women, and things like CrossFit.
It's a cult.
I'm not like an evangelist. Yeah, it's totally a cult. But, like, I think this idea of, like, women saying, oh, women don't have the upper body strength, whatever, like, go to a CrossFit gym. Like, watch women crank out 30 pull-ups. Like, watch them dust you in a run. Watch them out deadlift you. Watch the, you know, do all these things. So, I mean, I think it's a good start. But, like, this idea that, like, oh, women are never going to be able to make it through these, you know, programs is has no basis in reality. Yeah. And I think the more in representation does matter. Like, I only became a reporter because I met a guy at the Times who was a former Marine who became a reporter. And I was like, oh, I can see some of myself in you. I could see myself doing that job. And I think the more women you have in armor, infantry, special forces, all these other branches, they'll find mentors that will say, yeah, come on, I'll show you how to do this.
The pithier answer is it's not a priority for this administration. In fact, there are senior folks pretty hostile to it. And you won't see a great deal of improvement over the next few years as a result.
My pithier answer is that much of the policy of the Department of Defense is set by the sexual hangups of senior military officers. But, you know, I won't say that to their face. Maybe I will. Aaron, this question is for you and anyone else you'd like to answer.
Is it in my mother's handwriting?
No.
Okay.
Do you believe that our increasing technological superiority, like drones, has contributed to the disconnection of the American people from war? Great question.
That is a great question. I don't think so. I mean, so the American, there's a great book by Wegley on the American way of war, and the American way of war has always had a pretty close relationship to technology, whatever that technology was at the time. Partially because we didn't have a standing army, partially because we came to have a great deal of industrial power and technical acumen. The American military did not deploy as just like a mass infantry, untrained, you know, hordes. We deployed with sophisticated ships and eventually aircraft and all of that. So I don't think that contributes to the disconnect, but I do think that the intersection of the all-volunteer force, right, that this increasing sophistication of weaponry that we have today requires specialization, which is part of why the senior military leadership does not stand in favor of returning to a draft army, because they want really highly trained pilots. They want highly trained radio and communications operators. They want highly trained specialists in a whole variety of what we call military occupational specialties that would be hard to get, you know, somebody on a 1 year or 2 year kind of draft tour up to speed on. So there's a relationship perhaps between technical sophistication and challenges of a draft army. But I don't think it's the technology itself that drives that. It's about the way that we want to employ that in a complex battle space.
And I would jump on that because I agree completely, but I do think that the technology, the over-reliance on technology does drive a wedge, not necessarily between the American public and the military, but between the military and itself, in the sense that there are moral and ethical issues of push-button warfare that enter into the equation that people don't like to talk about. But there's a reality that if you don't, Waverly is a great example. An American way of war is that even though we want to fight and win a war and do so in as symmetrical a way as possible, we really want to do it asymmetrically. But to get an asymmetric advantage over your opponent often means I'm going to blow you up with a drone. And I can do it.
H.R. McMaster, right? There's two kinds of war, asymmetric and stupid.
Yeah. But it's there's something to be said about the looking your opponent in the eye kind of thing that is endemic to our culture, that when you take that out of the equation, there's moral and ethical issues that you have to contend with. And I think that's a real issue.
So I'm going to take the last question. I will own the last question myself, because something that I've noticed throughout this whole conversation and went to talk about earlier is that one of the elements of the civil-military divide is how folks who are in the national security community, and particularly folks in the military, how they talk. They talk in ways that are very distant from the actions that they take. Steve earlier, and I was going to jump on this, he used the term kinetic and he used the term direct action. That just means kill people. And we do that. We say this in a way in order to, in some ways, to kind of distance ourselves from the actions that we take as U.S. military and the national security community. On the other hand, there's a lot of stuff that the military says and that the Defense Department says that is hilarious and just like weird terms that you find in this community. So my question for all of you is, what is your favorite DOD or military slang that most people outside that community don't understand?
So can we swear?
That by all means.
So last week
your
I was in a meeting.
Your mom's not here.
And I have been in higher education now for 3 years. And I usually don't default to the terms like kinetic and direct action. I apologize. I've learned better than that. But I was in a meeting with an associate of mine, a colleague of mine. And during the meeting, she said, "This is a complete goat fuck." And then she looked at me and she said, "Did I use it right?" And I said, "My work here is done. I can now leave." And that is my favorite term, by the way. I apologize.
I worked for the FBI for a while, and I was reprimanded formally for using that term while working at the FBI. It's in my permanent record somewhere.
I can tell you, one thing is watching acronyms like spin out of nothing. And the fight in Iraq is the IED, improvised bombs became more of a problem. They wanted to have a group of people that could look at the parts and pieces and try and pull fingerprints and things, and they called it the Combined Explosives Exploitation Cell, which they pronounce sexy. And a friend of mine, yeah, no, it's sexy Afghanistan, sexy Iraq, like sexy Philippines. But there was sexy Thailand too.
That's different.
That's different.
That
yeah.
is a different problem set.
I promise this is a true story. A friend of mine, I won't say his name, but when he was in Iraq before I got there, he started putting on briefs that he said, we should, like in a PowerPoint, like, we'll send the Foreign Ordnance Exploitation Cell, FOXI. So, like, if there's a sexy, there should be a FOXI. The problem is FOXI didn't exist until some general was like, "What about the FOXI team?" And they're like, "Oh, no, we actually have to create a FOXI team because the general thinks it exists." And so
I don't know if I have an actual my first job was with the Marine Corps, and for those of you who've never met my dad, you'll know that I was very well raised to work with Marines as a young person because I swear, well, not like a sailor, but like a Marine. And so they have lots of odd aphorisms like ass over tea kettle or get your, soup sandwich or these sorts of things. But I think my favorite is actually bogsad, which is bunch of guys sitting around a table. And it sounds like you did something. Oh, I'm going to go to that bog set on Thursday. And it's just about when you're trying to, like, make something up and have a vague methodology for having done so. So,
well, I will tell you mine, which is a good way of closing this whole discussion. So for years, I would attend meetings, and people would say at the end, "Any save rounds? Any alibis?" And I'd be like, "I have zero idea what that means, but what it eventually kind of understood, it's like, did you have a final point to make? And none of us have final points to make. It was from the firing range. If you had any extra rounds in order to use, those were called alibis or safe rounds. I won't get into the specific detail about why. But for the longest time, it was like, what is this strange world that I'm in? You're like asking, like, do you have an alibi? No, I didn't commit a crime. What are you talking about? So with no saved rounds or alibis, nope. I want to thank you all so much for coming to our live Bombshell podcast. And I hope you listen to more of us, and we'll talk to you soon.